Thank you. First of all, a disclaimer. This is I'm not David Corey. so I was asked a bit last minute to give this talk. So I put something quick together, and this is the first time I present it, so there might be a lot of things that are not working necessarily well in it. But and also my subfield is AMO theory, so I know not much about dark energy or dark matter, but I learned a lot during this workshop. So the hope of this talk is to see that we could potentially, if there are variations in those fundamental constant, that AMO system, atomic, molecular, and optical systems, could be used to probe them. By the way, this is the dome where the women basketball team at UConn. I don't know if any of you are basketball fans. Probably not. Yeah. Then you would know that this year, both men and women teams at University of Connecticut won the championship. That's been done once before by UConn, and so they're proud of that, and hopefully the funding from the state will follow. So I'm pretty happy that you have a stick here, because actually I worked very hard on this logo for my group. My group is about ultra-cold collisions, and I'm originally from Canada, so I thought that ice hockey is a good example of cold collision. So I'm pretty proud to have a stick to present. So I will quickly go over motivation, but I will talk more about photoassociation. So I have no clue if how familiar people are with this topic. It's kind of straightforward, but I will talk a bit about it. I will talk about flashback resonances, which is one of the tools that experimentalists have in AMO systems to be able to vary at will the interaction between particles. And then I'll talk about the link of those techniques to look at mass ratio, a variation of the mass ratio. I'll look at various systems and mention some other approaches that people are also thinking of using. So why are we looking at this? Well, you know, there was a hint from quasars that there might be some variation of fundamental constant. I don't know much more than that. You know all about it. That's one of the motivation for people to look into AMO systems for that. Now, ultra-cold atomic systems, one of the interesting thing about them is that they allow very precise measurements, and you can really control to a very good degree the various interactions and the environment. Now the question is, of course, is that degree of control high enough? That is the question actually today. So remember, we had talks about atomic clocks, and this is one of the great advantage of atomic clocks. You can really push the accuracy to, you know, 10 minus 19 or 10 minus 18, depending. So this talk is about the identification, at least to find systems where some properties of the system could be used to probe or to enhance some of the small effects that we could be looking for. And that would be, for example, if you have resonances. If you can have properties that are very sensitive to the position of resonances or the strength of the coupling between the states that are coupled, then there might be ways to use AMO system. Many people worked on that from the AMO side. That was kind of initiated by Flambaum. He collaborated with Chen Chin at Chicago, Junier at Svetlana Kutechigova, Dave DeMille worked together on some papers as well, on trying to locate or to find AMO systems that could be used. So, again, the family of ultra-cold atoms is growing quickly. All the alkali atoms, alkaline earth, except for beryllium because it's a bit nasty, have been cooled down to very low temperatures. Chromium, you can go. There's erbium, ytterbium, and there's dysprosium. Where is dysprosium on this? Here, dysprosium. So those guys are all atoms that have all kinds of interesting characteristics and properties that could be used to probe more fundamental questions. So this is, sorry about that, this is an old view graphs about scattering length. So, but I thought it would be interesting to introduce it. So scattering length is really nothing else than how your wave function, when it goes through an interaction, is shifted. The thing with scattering length in atomic systems is that it's very sensitive to the location of the last bound state. Because you have systems which are pretty heavy, you have many bound states, and the exact position of that scattering length is therefore sensitive to the mass of the system. So, you know, for people who worked in BEC, the big questions in 1994, 1995, does a system with a negative scattering length would condense or not? Those were big questions at the time. So the thing is if you have a system with a scattering length which is positive, the system will be, the condensate will be stable. If not, it will be quasi-stable. It's unstable, but for a small condensate, it would be stable. Anyway, the point is, with the scattering length, people use that for the elastic collisions. To cool the gases to very low temperatures, you just cut the distribution, they thermalize, and they can get to very cold gases. Anyway, so I won't go in more details there. This is just a quick thing about cold collisions. Now, the main topic of this talk is how to use photo association to maybe probe those changes in the mass ratio. And the reason for that is that photo association probes two things. Probes the ground state interaction between two atoms and an excited state that you're trying to produce. So you take two atoms, you shine a laser, and you photo associate them into a molecule. And the rate of photo association given here is actually depends very much on the overlap of the wave function, the ground state, and the upper state. So basically, it is optimal when the maximum of your wave function here hit the last lobe of your wave function. And of course, if you go from this state to a deeper state into a deeper state, this lobe is moving inward. And at some point, what you will do by doing photo association, you will map out the nodal structure of your wave function here. And the exact nodal structure is depend on the mass, of course, of the system. So if you do photo association experiment, you would get something like this. This is for strontium, and this is the signal as a function of the detuning. The detuning is just how far you are from the asymptote here. So you detune, red detune, and when you do that, you are moving in this direction. So you see, this is on a log scale, so you see the first node, a second node, and you can guess there's a third node there. By fitting this data, you get an estimate of the value of the scattering length, which is very sensitive, again, to the position of the bound states. And actually, by fitting those parameters, those line shapes, etc., you can get information about retardation effects, even in the case of strontium. So you can get fairly precise measurements, although it's not that precise. And when you look at that, you say, well, I'd like to maybe map out more of the wave function. How would you do that? But the problem with photo association, again, is that, is that when you look at this, as you go to deeper, lower and lower states here, the probability of being, or the overlap of this part of the wave function gets smaller and smaller, and at some point you don't get any signal. So the thing to do is to look at other ways to get to the shorter range of the potential. One way to do that is to maybe use Feshbach resonance. So what is a Feshbach resonance? Well, it's when you have a incoming particles that overlap or are resonant with the energy of a closed channel in some other curve, some other state. And what happens is basically you have your two, let's say it's a spin, they come like this. They cannot, you would like to form a molecule and dance together for a little while, but they cannot, so they have to get out. And the fact that they spend more time, you get this resonance. So, and that means that they stay at short distance a bit longer, so it's easier to, more probable to excite short range molecules. So that was the breakthrough, if you want, that some people used in to be able to control the interactions between atoms. And there were measurements of photoassociation, for example, in lithium-7 by Randy Hewlett, and a few other people did that. But for some reason, not many people have gone into that arena, if you want. So, how does it work? So what you have is you have your incoming state, you couple to a closed channel, which means that in a way you're coupling the blue and the green wave functions, you mix them up. And by mixing them up, you will have a larger probability at short distance, a better overlap, to be able to excite states at short distance. And that way you're able to probe things at shorter distance. To do that, well, you just, technically speaking, you just have to put the hyperfine interactions, the Zeeman terms, and higher order terms also in it. This is not important. You put that into your expression for the photoassociation rate, and what you get is something that looks like this. As a function of the magnetic field, if you look at the rate coefficient for different levels that you would probe, of your bound state that you would probe, you'll get something that looks like this. You have a sharp increase. In this case, there's two Feshbach resonances. So if you take, this is level, which level was that, 10, I think. If you just take level 10, you take a cross section here, this is how it looks like. This is the rate. And this is as a function of the magnetic field, this is the scattering length. So you have a Feshbach resonance here, another one here. And whenever you hit the Feshbach resonance, you have an increase in the rate coefficient to produce the molecules. And that increase can be very large, many orders of magnitude. Why? Well, this is not a big secret. It's because you're mixing. If you look at the wave function and you zoom at short distance here, what you find is that the red curve, which is if you have no, you're far away from the resonance, the red curve is now increased or enhanced at short distance, it becomes the black curve. So now you get this larger increase and larger overlap at short distances. So how does it work? Simple two channel model. You mix the closed channel, and what you have is basically in your system, the dipole matrix element, if you want, will have a off-resonant part, and the resonance will be taken care of by the phase shift here, this resonant phase shift. And that simple model actually explains fairly well the numerical results we've got. So if you look at the scattering length, again, as a function of the magnetic field, the little dots were calculations of multi-channel calculation, and the red curve is just a small two-channel model with the right parameters, which are given here. So, and if you take this little model, you put that into the rate coefficient, you get something of the same shape, and everything seems to be working very well. Now, there were experiments done by Randy Hewlett on lithium-2. So Randy is at Rice University, and he's been very good with working with ultra-cold gases, both bosonic and fermionic. And if you look at the, as a function of the magnetic field, again, the rate coefficient for various levels that you excite, you find that you have the following. You have this peak, which is at the resonance, and you have a dip there. So this is the, again, as a function of the B field, your scattering length, you get a big increase like this. And this is the rate coefficient. You get a dip and a maximum. And if you look at the measurements, these were the measurements of Randy Hewlett. So the green dots are the measurements as a function, again, of the B field. And what he observed is indeed a dip followed by some increase. And the calculation fitted pretty well. The interesting thing is that actually you cannot get a big peak here. You have some saturation effects. You cannot go more than the dashed line. The dashed line just tells you that all atoms are excited, are making pairs. And the interesting thing, though, is not the maximum. It's not the maximum. It's actually the minimum. If you look at the minimum, which is, this is a plot, this is the maximum for different vibrational level, and this is the minimum. The minimum does this crescent type trajectory, if you want. And the location of the minimum was moving, has been observed by Randy Hewlett, and that would allow you to do pretty high precision spectroscopy, because the minimum depends on the fact that the overlap becomes extremely poor, and that overlap becoming very poor between the ground state and the excited is very sensitive to the wave function itself, very sensitive to the resonance. So this is a bit of a background for the topic. The variation of the mass. Flambaum wrote a paper where he said, well, since we have a resonance and it's very sensitive to the position, the exact position of relative states, if we, instead of looking at the mass ratio itself, if we look at a different quantity, the variation of the scattering length instead, that might be enhancing the effect. And therefore, if you get an enhancement factor here, this thing, this zeta A, you might be able to measure something which is very small otherwise. And the idea was that if you look, they obtained this expression that has few features. One is this here. So if the scattering length is becoming very large, it scales like A. So if the scattering length becomes extremely large, you can get a big enhancement factor. Also, the density of state might be not too large, small, let's say. And if the coupling strength is small, you get also a big enhancement factor. So they postulated that you could use that instead of trying to measure the levels themselves. If you actually look at this, one of the derived properties, scattering length, you could maybe obtain information on the mass ratio, variation of the mass ratio. So instead of looking at the scattering length, you said, let's look at the photoassociation rate. So again, this is a bit the same thing. So you have, as a function of the B field, this is for lithium again, you have the scattering length, looks like this. This is the expression to parameterize your scattering length. It has a background value, a width, which is not a real width, it's a width for fitting, if you want, and a position of the resonance. And this is, again, the kind of results we're getting before. It's at low intensity, you get a dip and a maximum. What we want to do now is to look at how the variation of the rate can be parameterized in such a way that you get an enhancement factor that would be maybe even larger than what you would get for the scattering length itself. One little issue, though, is that you have saturation effects if you are at the resonance. So this is, again, B field. This is a position of the resonance. This dashed line here is the maximum you could get, which is just saying that the S matrix here is equal to 1. Then everything is photo associated. So if you try to do photo association near the maximum, the problem is you'll get saturation effects and it will be very difficult to measure. The interesting thing is what happens here. You have also a very sharp variation of your rate near the minimum. And the idea is to try to concentrate our attention on the minimum. So, well, this is basically what I was saying. If you stay near the minimum, the rate coefficient can be written in terms of something with the phase shift of the resonance. And if you take the expression for the scattering length, you can put everything in terms of a background scattering length and the scattering length near the resonance. So, or near the minimum in this case, which happens to be at the resonance. And what you find we did the calculation for various intensity of the lasers, you find that near the minimum, all if you look at the variation of the rate as a function of the B field, they're basically all overlapping here. They're not sensitive. But near the maximum, it's very sensitive. So the idea is, let's concentrate on the minimum where things are very stable. So if you look at the variation of the rate with respect to the various parameters, you have the scattering length, the background scattering length, well, K, let's say. You find out that you can find, using the simple expression, you can find how those behave. And now you use them to put into the first expression. But we already know how delta A varies with beta. This was done by Flambaum. You get something very similar for the background, but it turns out that this zeta A is much larger than zeta background. So in all, I can basically neglect this term. And if I do that, I get a simple expression, finally, for the rate coefficient, the variation of the rate coefficient near the minimum. And it can be parameterized by xi b. And this now, by using the scattering length in terms of the B field, etc., you find this simple expression. Now, this is the maximum you would get at the resonance, B naught. You also get an enhancement at this minimum. So what we are saying is, instead of trying to put your B field at the maximum where you'll get a lot of noise, a lot of saturation effects, and you won't be able to distinguish or have a clean signal, if you try to do your experiment near the minimum, you will still get a big enhancement, the same amplitude, if you want. So this is a kind of enhancement we are getting, if you want. Again, for the same level of lithium, you see that near the minimum here, this region here is not mapped because the expressions are not valid. So you would get some big peak there also, but the expressions are not valid, you get saturation effects. I don't put that there. So if you look at this and you say, well, I can get a magnetic field stability of, let's say, one Gauss or 1 milligauss or whatever, then if you take 10 milligauss, you will get this enhancement factor would be 10 to the 8. So if there's a variation of the B field, it would of the mass, you will be amplifying it by 10 to the 8, which is a nice feature. Now you could do better. So this would give you a variation of 10 to the minus 11, if there's a variation, to be able to detect something like 10 to the minus 11 in terms of the mass ratio variation. You could go for different systems. If you go for systems that have different masses or different characteristics for the resonances, so a narrower resonance would actually have a better enhancement factor. This is a case of lithium sodium. Yes, I did. And with a 0.02 Gauss, so 20 milligauss, with the width and accuracy of 1 milligauss for the stability of the field, you'll get 10 to the 9 for the other, for the enhancement ratio, and 10 minus 13 for the mass variation. Okay. Window crashed. No. Okay. No. No. Okay. So, what we missed. We're getting near the end.
How do you practically think it's possible? So it should be like some short scale variability that you will be detecting, or you want to do this experiment today and return to after a year?
It should probably be done over, you know, average results on a short time period, and redo it a year later, and redo it a year later. So you get enough statistics on short time, and then redo it, and that would be the what I would suggest would be the right way to proceed. So okay, hopefully it doesn't crash. No. So you can enhance that enhancement even further by taking systems that have first are heavier. If they are heavier, they have a large number of bound state, and a number in 0.2 is the enhancement is proportional to how many bound state you have. Turns out, you will have, for example, very narrow resonances. So if you the Feshbach resonances for higher angular momenta can be very narrow. So that would also increase the sensitivity. And some systems, like erbium and dysprosium, they have a lot of resonances at very low magnetic field. And if the magnetic field is small, people can get very, very, very accurate or very stable field. And it can go down maybe even to 0.1 milligauss. So if you put all those things together, you could get in the range of 10 minus 15, 10 minus 16. Anyway, so if there's anything that scale would be
happening every year.
I think it's per year. Now you could enhance that even further by using instead of doing that in a gas, doing that in optical lattices. So you put two atoms in an optical site. And you can image them, both of them separately, and then you see if they form a molecule. You can ionize that, and you know if you made a molecule. So things can be done really single particle if you want. Then you could increase those measurements. There were other proposals. I'm finishing up by talking about other proposals out there. One of them, which was by Junyi and others in 2008, the idea there was to actually look at the variation of two bound state, the distance, if you want, in frequency, or the position of two bound states, one which is deep, where it's actually a harmonic oscillator, and one which is in the upper part, where then if the mass is scaling, the position, how those bound states would move as a function of time would be different. And you could, by measuring very accurately the motion, or how if there's a shift between the separation of those two lines using very accurate lasers, you might be able to observe a shift. Another similar proposal, in a way, was by Dave DeMille and co-workers. And in this proposal, the idea is to measure two systems where two states in a molecule, one which is levels where states that are basically not varying much with the mass, if you want, and one that is varying a lot with the mass. So if you look at the difference between those two guys, if the mass is changing, the frequency difference between them, or the energy difference, would be visible. So this is very similar in spirit to what the previous proposal was. And the idea is that if you have those two guys here and this guy, the red position would not move a lot, but the blue one could move a lot. So if you look at how the state here would move over time, it might move here and the other one move a bit less. So by measuring the relative positions of those bound states of those features, you might be able to observe something. One other approach is to look at, for example, this was by Bethlehems and Urbach, looking at CH3 and NH2, and there's a torsion frequency, and basically between, and you have tunneling between those two minima, and by measuring the change of that frequency over time, you would also be able to determine if there's a change. They found that the rate, the change would be smaller. It's consistent of something smaller than 10 minus 6 from their experiment. So they had experimental data for that. And that brings me to my last slide. Should I go back? No? Okay. And thinking about systems, can we identify AMO systems that would have those kind of properties? One interesting thing that I worked on for other reasons was for quantum information purposes to try to use molecular ions to map out to ask qubits. But anyway, while doing those calculations, we found this kind of interesting structure. At least for an AMO theorist, this is interesting structure. What you find is actually, you see this blue curve. This blue curve is below the red curve. So this is an excited state, electronic state, which is actually more bound, if you want, than the ground state here. And the symmetry of this state is the same as the lower state. That means if you have a bound state here, it will decay by a quadrupole radiation. So it would have a very narrow width. And the interesting thing then is that if it's narrow and you have another bound state from this guy, almost degenerate, if you want, very close, if the mass is changing over time, the rate of movement of the two bound states will be very different, and they would maybe hit each other, if you want. And because there's interaction between them, they would repel each other. So now you could look at those guys, a bunch of states from this one and from the blue one, how they move as a function of time. They should all move, but there's two of them that instead of moving all together, two of them would somehow move in the other direction or have a split between them over time. And you could do that with different isotopes, which has different masses, and they have therefore the position at different place. And by doing that, you could hope to be able to say, okay, this pair of states seems to be moving in other direction, and we can identify that the reason for this cannot be explained by other reasons, like somehow the coupling is changing, etc. That will be due to the mass. So, I thought something happened, but it's okay. So anyway, that's the main message. But yesterday I had a discussion about that at lunch with Misha Lukin and a few other people. The conclusion is that if you have ultra-cold systems, it opens up a new energy regime, the very low energy. And because of the very good control you have on the interactions, especially Feshbach resonances, and you control the internal and external degrees of freedom of your system, you can hope to control everything and be able to detect very, very small changes. But there's a system I was mentioning also walking up here. I worked on something totally unrelated, which is if you put Rydberg atoms in a bose-Einstein condensate. If you put Rydberg atoms in bose-Einstein condensate, what happens is you have the electron, which is scattering off. So it's a Rydberg atom, big, faraway electron. it scatters off the condensate atoms. It creates, well, you have phonons, and then you have two Rydberg atoms that now talk to each other in terms of phonon interaction, exchange if you want. And you can you get a 1 over R or Yukawa potential between two neutrals. So now you get this nice Yukawa potential where you can control the charge and the parameter of your Yukawa potential, and then if you choose by choosing the different element for your condensate, you can tune that. But also you can choose different Rydberg states. If you choose different Rydberg state, you can have this interaction, instead of being attractive, you can have it repulsive. Now the interesting question, and I didn't put any numbers, but the interesting question is, could one get numbers that would be able to compensate for gravity, the 1 over R, so that you get something, and I don't know, it's probably very small, it probably won't work, but anyway, it's intriguing. So if you get, you're able to compensate for gravity, the 1 over R, and then and the range for that is actually in the range of 10 to 100 microkelvin, micrometers, which is the range that everybody was talking about. The range of those Rydberg-Rydberg interactions is in the range of 10 to 50, maybe 10 micron. So anyway, I have to put numbers in there and see if it makes sense. Probably not, but anyway, it's intriguing enough to me. So with that, I thank you for your attention.
Questions?
This measurement based on flashback resonance, assuming that you want to do this over the year, assumes that you have to control the, or standardize the magnetic field, that the magnetic field that is applied to the sample after 1 year is in absolute terms. So it has to be referenced to the standard, the same field you applied a year ago.
Yes, it would. And that's why I'm happy to be a theorist and not an experimentalist. I must agree, this would be a very difficult task to have.
What about lasers? Because I guess you have to ionize do the lasers introduce any...
The best lasers at this point, the width of the laser, I think, is... It's in millihertz. They're able to go, I think it's 50, it might be 30 millihertz, the width of the laser. So if anything, so to go between states.
My concern is whether they introduce, because this field sort of, the stability of the field must be, you mentioned milligauss, so it's something like 100 hertz or hundreds of hertz. If the laser, because I guess these are molecules, if you want to ionize detectors, do something, you have to apply power. And then what about late shifts?
Well, if you form, you mean the AC shifts? That would be something that would need to be taken into account. But if you form the molecule, then you ionize it. So the thing is, you have two atoms, you form the excited molecule, and then you ionize it. So the first step to form them, you should be at low, with a minimum, it's where there's low laser intensity, those effects should not be large. Once you form them, then you blast them away to detect them. But that should not affect the association rate.
I think this scattering length thing is the only suggestion where the measured thing is not the frequency, but the scattering length in terms of resonance. But as actually, I think you pointed out, in fact, what you are measuring there is the position of the resonance, not the scattering length, but the position of the magnetic field. So it's still measuring of either magnetic field or the frequency of the resonance, whatever. So it's
Well, but if you measure basically near the minimum, if you measure, you want to measure the slope there, so you need to be very close.
Yeah, if you can fix the magnetic field, then you can measure the scattering length. But I think that you rather will be scanning the magnetic field than looking where your resonance is actually.
Well, what they probably will do is scan.
Yes.
Scan, and then the I would guess if the rate would change, so the position may be changing, but if the rate would change, that would give you the information. So if the slope, so the position could be shifted, but if the slope is you could analyze the slope changing over time. That would be
For exactly the same magnitude.
Yeah.
All right, say another game.